Waiting on a tax return? Hopefully it ends up in your hands. Fraudulent tax returns due to identity theft increased by 30% in 2023. If you're in a bind this tax season, LifeLock can help. Our U.S.-based restoration specialists are experts dedicated to helping solve your identity theft issues. And all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package. So we'll reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. Help protect your information this tax season with LifeLock. Save up to 25% your first year at LifeLock.com/aware.
The sound of praise for your Sunday morning.
The only one who could ever teach me.
Introducing Reverend A.R. Bernard of the Christian Cultural Center.
Was the son of a preacher man.
And Rabbi Joseph Potasnik of Religion on the Line.
The only one who could ever teach me.
Now, on Talk Radio 77 WABC, here's the Reb and the Rabbi, where faith matters.
Good morning, I'm Rabbi Joseph Potasnik.
And I'm Reverend A.R. Bernard.
Reverend, I heard about someone who desperately needed a parking spot in the lot, and he looked up to God. He said, God, please, if you get me a spot, I'll come to services every Sabbath. Please. All of a sudden, somebody pulled out of the spot. He looked up. He says, God, I don't need you anymore. I got the spot. All right? And there
Is
are
that
people.
What we do to God?
Right? We'll bargain with him when we need it. And all of a sudden, no, wait a minute. I don't need you right now. Yeah. Anyway, we got a few minutes. We got two amazing guests today, but you were at Teachers College this week, weren't you?
Yeah. It was an event that the mayor's office put together on mental health. We had 350 clergy. Chloe Breyer, you know, dear friend of yours, was there. And we had a panel discussion. I was there with another doctor, and Dr. Amra El Reyes, who actually is from Bosnia, an incredible story of how she came to the United States. But it was just working together to facilitate mental health amongst clergy. It's kind of like healing the healers. Mm-hmm. We are busy trying to heal people and help them and bind up the wounds for people. Who do we go to? Who heals the healer?
Care to the caregivers. Yep.
Yeah. And it was a great event. Our mayor was there, our illustrious mayor, and he reiterated publicly his support for the faith community. And he's got going back. In fact, he said that he would like New York City to be a city where people experience God, not in terms of religious beliefs, but in terms of our actions, how we reach out to the disenfranchised, the marginalized, the least of these in society. It was pretty good.
You know, when I see people who are besieged with so many problems, when you see young people who resort to violence, when you see other people who are on the streets, homeless and hungry, I say to myself, there's a lot of place here for faith. There's a lot that faith can do. So let's not exclude it. We don't seek to impose it. We seek to integrate it in a constructive way. Yeah, that, I think,
fruit.
Is right.
Yeah, the fruit of our faith. Yep. Let's see the fruit of it. Let's see, you know, what happens when he did good. I mean, he did a good speech. It was a great presentation because he started saying that when God is present, all right, we should see people reaching out to the homeless. We should see people, you know, feeding those who are hungry. We should see people doing all of these things that speak of our value for the human person.
Well, today we have two people of deep faith. Sister Jean, who many have seen on TV, courtside with Loyola men's basketball team, and she's 103 years young and wrote a book entitled Wake Up with Purpose. We also have Rabbi Sarah Horowitz, the first Orthodox rabbi to be ordained in this country, in the world. Two people of faith, different generations. Let's see what they have in common.
In celebration of Women's History Month, we'll be back. Stay tuned for more of the Rev and the Rabbi.
Where faith matters. The Rev and the Rabbi. Talk Radio 77 WABC.
Welcome back. I'm Rabbi Joseph Potasnik.
And I'm Reverend A.R. Bernard.
Reverend, today we have on the program one of the youngest guests we've ever had since we began radio. Sister Jean. Full name is Sister Jean Schmidt. She is 103 years young. author of a book entitled Wake Up with Purpose. She's with the Sisters of Charity of the Blessed Virgin Mary, a chaplain for Loyola men's basketball team. She also does scouting reports for the team. It's a great honor. Sister Jean, welcome to the Reverend the Rabbi.
Thank you. Thank you so much. It pleases me to be with you today.
It's amazing, Sister Jean. Your voice sounds strong, alert, I mean, in full control. You are an inspiration just talking to you this morning. Where do we start, Rabbi?
Well,
I mean, this is a lot of time to cover, well, 103 years.
Commissioner Cassano, former FDNY commissioner, said, please ask Sister Jean what her diet is, because we all want to live to at least 103 and keep going. Because in Jewish tradition, you know, sister, we bless people by saying, may you live to 120. And with inflation, that's gone even higher than that. So if you've been asked this many times, what do you ascribe to longevity in your life?
Well, first of all, I say that I eat well, I sleep well, and hopefully I pray well. Those three things are very important in my life. When I say I eat well, you know, at 103, what difference does it make if you use a lot of salt? They say, no, you can't have salt. Well, yes, I can. It's not going to bother me now. My system is used to it, or whatever they say, you know, is not good for me. I don't say no to anything like that. And I sleep well. I don't take anything to make me sleep. I just sleep. I get tired enough during the day that I want to do that. And pray. Well, I follow my regular pray schedule, beginning with a morning meditation of half an hour. And then since COVID, I've been attending Mass from my iPad, going to Toronto every morning. I take that little trip to Canada and have a wonderful liturgy celebration every day. It's
fundamental. It's you know, you're talking about things that are just fundamental in life.
And quality, sleep, and prayer. Did you hear that?
Yeah.
If I may, Rabbi, because I'm just fascinated. We've got so much to cover, we can't do it in a whole show. But Sister Jean, I understand that after graduating from high school in 1937, you entered Sisters of Charity of the Blessed Virgin Mary, Covenant in Iowa. Help us understand what led to that kind of life decision. And it was a life decision that you made.
Well, sometimes this sounds as though it's not true, but it is true. When I was in third grade, we had this wonderful sister, brand new sister. We learned later we were her first class. She was young. She was a teacher. She was a sister. I always wanted to be a teacher when I was a little kid and we played school with the neighbors. I always said I had to be the teacher, and everybody in the neighborhood accepted it. So I thought teacher would be fine. My mom had a sister and a niece in the religious community. My dad had a sister in the religious community. I had two aunts who taught in the public schools in San Francisco. So when I saw what Sister Patrice, my third grade teacher, was doing, that she was a teacher and a sister at the same time, I thought, well, I can do that too. When she talked about vocation and said to us, you're not too young to be thinking about what you want to do when you grow up. And so I thought, well, that's what I want to do. So every morning I would pray to God and say, oh, God, please help me decide what I should do. But tell me that I'll be a BVM sister. That's what we call the Sisters of Charity of the Blessed Virgin Mary. I did that every day. I never changed my mind. And, you know, as little kids thought about this, they were telling everybody what they wanted to do. But as we grew older, you know, like getting to eighth grade and stuff like that, well, we didn't say anything because you didn't want to be cheated out of the parties or the graduation fairs and all that kind of thing. So until I was a senior. Then I mentioned that to one of the sisters that I was going to Dubuque. And so she said, well, did you write and ask if you could come? And I said, write and ask? I was just going to go. And she said, that's not the way we do it. You know, you have to write and ask if you can go. So I did that, wrote and asked if I could go to Dubuque and be a sister. And I got, my response was yes. So that's where I went. Never regretted a day.
Wow. And I'm just going to ask you that. If you ever look back and said, I should have done this differently. And it seems to me you didn't. I think I understand why your book is entitled Growing Up with Purpose, because at an early age, you felt you had a purpose.
I did. I did. And that was sort of proved to me as I went, I got to eighth grade, and one of the sisters, who a retired sister who lived at the convent, had a mother who was dying, and she lived in Oakland, and sister had made the trip over there every day. And in those days, we had to have companions. So the first grade teacher was assigned to go with her as her companion every day. And so my eighth grade teacher asked me if I would take over the first grade. Here I was, like 12 years old, and these little kids were my students. And so I just followed the work that sister planned for the week and took over the first grade. And then, of course, I had to do my own work so I wouldn't be lagging behind, because I was working for a scholarship from eighth grade to high school, and I didn't want to lose that if I could win it. Mm. Yes, I did win it. And I had a great time with that first grade. In high school, I was in charge of the tardy bell. And I'm telling you, I had to be kind to my friends and hold my breath so they could get into their classroom before I rang that bell. Otherwise, you'd be marked tardy. Mm. And I also, when I was a junior, I was responsible for setting up for our physics experiments on our lab days. When I was a senior, I was responsible for setting up for our chemistry. So I had to think what day of the week it was and what I was going to do. And so to me, that was also having a purpose.
Wow.
It's just, I have to ask this. You lived through two world wars, Great Depression, political, social, and moral changes. In the 1960s, every revolution imaginable. You know, how do you see where we are as a society today compared to where we were through that journey of the last century?
Well, just at the end of the World War One, when the flu and everything was so bad, that's when I came along, was in 1919. So I missed part of that. But for the other things, it seemed to me, for example, like in the Depression time in World War II, that people worked more as teams together and helped each other out than we did for many years until COVID came. And then when COVID came along, I'm not saying it was a blessing, but people began to do block parties or take care for their neighbor and talk to their neighbor whom maybe they never met before, but all of a sudden they became interested in and helping them. I hope that helping and assistance can continue. I hope that our acceptance of all cultures and races will develop. But that's only going to happen if we all talk to each other. We can't have certain kinds of groups just talking by themselves. We have to talk to each other and say, this is what I like about you. This is what I don't like about you. This is what we can do, and this is what we can't do. We can't do everything. We can do some things. We can work with our heart and with our head. And the heart is what's so important. And we have to be able to shake hands and really mean it. So we have a lot of work to do yet. now. We slipped back for ages, for decades. So let's get together and just do a thing. We can prove that young people don't pay attention to each color or race. They're just friends. And athletes are probably the best ones to get along together with different cultures and different races. So if that can be done that way, the rest of us better take a lesson and do it too.
Sister, before we get on the air, you mentioned that years ago you also got involved in interfaith dialogue. You met with, I think it was Rabbi Shalman. You would bring groups over to learn about Judaism, learn about a different faith, and see ways of cooperation. Talk about that.
Well, yes. We became very ecumenical, and that's what it's all about. And Rabbi Shalman even came to Mundelein College, where I was at that time. And we used to go to his synagogue to have him explain just exactly what they were doing and what the relationship was between Catholicism and Judaism. And, you know, he was such a gentle man and such a scholar that he won people's hearts right away. And people were not afraid to ask him questions, and he never thought any question was unnecessary. And he would show us the scrolls and the Jewish synagogue. And everybody felt at home with Rabbi Shalman. And that was the beginning of understanding what was happening and how we perhaps have more likenesses than we have differences. Mm. And here at Loyola, we do the same thing. We have all kinds of cultures. Our campus ministry has even the ability for the Muslim students, for the water possibilities that they need. They have their own prayer room. We're trying to do things that bring all of us closer to God, and that's what's important. Some have their own profession of faith. Each one respects the faith of the other person. We're very accepting. So that's what we really have to think of if we're thinking of prayer. And prayer is simply talking to God. Hmm. That's my mother used to tell us that, you know, she started out by saying to us that, to my brothers and to me, that my dad, she and my dad loved us, but that God even loved us anymore, more than that. And so we had, every night we would say, "Oh God, we love you," before we went to bed. And that's true. And, you know, when you sit down with a friend, you don't read a book to a friend. You sit down and you talk to the friend. And so my mom used to say, just talk to God. Tell him what you want. Tell him what you don't want. And that was a very simple way of saying, you know, just ask him for stuff the way you ask your dad and me. So you can do that. Anybody can do that. Mm-hmm. We have God, but sometimes people believe in God in a different way, but they believe in God.
Sister, you've lived long enough to see women's role in American society go through incredible changes, and women are in positions of leadership today in an unprecedented way. They experience unprecedented education, upward mobility. Give us your comments on the changing role of women in American society.
Well, that's very true, because when I think back again to third grade, and there weren't very many choices for women for a vocation or a calling, because every calling is a vocation. There were nurses, there were secretaries, mostly secretaries, who were responsible, you know, for making the coffee in the morning, be sure to bring donuts or something to work. That was kind of a menial job, but it meant a lot to those people to have a job. So they were willing to do almost anything. The boys wanted to be firemen or policemen, and girls wanted to be teachers. Boys didn't think about being teachers. So anyhow, as time went on, and girls' schools started, boys' schools started. In fact, here in Chicago, we have a couple of schools where, as you pass by, you see engraved into the stone, girls' entrance, boys' entrance. Of course, that's just symbolic today. But that's what happened. Boys and girls were separated. Growing up together is what's normal. And so co-ed education came into being, and it's helped both because the competition has become greater in sports with Title IX. Everybody was moved up a bit, and with President Kennedy, he was the one who suggested that we have athletics, and that was a blessing, or just even to exercise and whatever. I will say that Title IX has done a lot to establish where women should be. And nowadays you find women as CEOs of big companies. And I think you choose people for a position, not just to fill that slot, but because the person is capable of doing that work. And I think that's what search committees have to keep in mind. You do not hire just to fill a slot. And it has to be how prepared this person is for a job. So I've seen a lot of that go on. We have some women activists who are maybe out of order sometimes when they're doing things. You have to be able to negotiate, and that's the best way to get something settled. It's not going to be by shouting. It's going to be by the quietness and the understanding and the way that some of these reporters are on some of the programs. I don't want to say names because I wouldn't want to leave out anybody important, but some of these women reporters are very good people. They're good analysts and they work hard. The men are good analysts and they work hard, whether it's analyzing a cold case or whether it's analyzing a basketball game.
So, sister, talking about basketball, anytime I mention your name to someone, immediately the response is, oh, that's the sister that sits courtside, and she's chaplain for the Loyola men's basketball team, gives scouting reports. And, sister, I got to ask you if this is true. There's a rumor out there that you also, on occasion, have cursed at referees.
Uh-oh. Rabbi would bring that up. I'm sorry, sister. I want to know, too. I want to know.
Sister, you got to confess here.
I confess the word cursed is not right, not in my language at all. I can tell you why I would never have it in my language. Before I go on to your question, when my little brother was about 5 or 6 years old, he came in one day. He was upset with something my mother said no to, and he called my mother an SOB. And my mother said, "What's that word?" He said, and he said it again. And she said, "Where did you learn that?" "Oh, a kid on the street told me it was a good word to use." So my mom took him into the bathroom and took a bar of soap and rubbed it on his tongue. And of course, the more he cried, the more bubbles came out. And then I started to cry. So I knew it was a bad word. So there were no bad words in my family. Like that. But no, I don't. But I have to confess that I do criticize them at times because I think they're unfair when they don't do their calling with equity. they're having a hard time getting referees to do games because they suffer too from coaches or from team members, but then they punish right away with a technical, so they don't get anything. What I think they need to do, I really believe that referees need to go for refresher courses periodically. Doctors have to do that. Teachers have to do that. Librarians have to do it. So I would think that referees might have to go for, they can call them refresher courses and bring them up to date, and how society, how athletes are changing too. And I've even said to them, you know, what I said, I think you need another fella on the court because you're all getting a little older. And these young men are getting a little faster. So I don't know. I have no influence there.
So no cursing, but constructive criticism. That's acceptable. I get
Oh,
it.
That's lovely. Thank you so much.
Absolutely amazing, sister. And this is Women's History Month. So it is a pleasure to have you on the program because you are women's history in America, in the context of faith. Just absolutely amazing. And you're still active. At 103 years old, you are still active.
Well, yeah, well, I'd like to be a little more active because I'm in a wheelchair. I'm in a wheelchair and it's confining, very confining. I had shingles in my right leg and the shingles destroyed my muscles and my nerves. And now I'm trying to get them back in order with a Botox injection. So I have the best looking foot in Chicago.
Well, we just say may you continue to be the inspiration that you are, and we certainly have been enriched by this conversation. Sister Jean Schmidt, thank you, and promise us we'll do this again next year.
All right, we'll make a date.
Okay,
I like that. And before we go, Rabbi, her book is available on Amazon and in bookstores. Right, and it's all about purpose. Wake up to purpose. I love it. Love the title.
Wake up with purpose. Yep.
That's
all
it.
Right.
Yeah. Wake up with purpose. Sister Jean, thank you for being on the program.
Be blessed, sister, and thank you for blessing us.
Thank Amen. You, and God bless you.
Bye bye.
All right, dear, and stay tuned for more of the Rev and the Rabbi right here on 77 WABC. We'll be back.
Reverend A.R. Bernard, Rabbi Joseph Potasnik, where faith matters. The Rev and the Rabbi, Talk Radio 77 WABC and the all-new WABCRadio.com.
Welcome back. I'm Rabbi Joseph Potasnik.
And I'm Reverend A.R. Bernard. Rabbi, you're going to make the introduction here, our next guest.
Reverend, we were privileged to have Sister Jean with us today, 103 years young. I'm not going to give you the age of our next guest, but she is significantly younger than 103. She's the first female Orthodox rabbi. She's the rabbi of the Hebrew Institute of Riverdale, president, co-founder of Yeshivat Maharat. She was listed by Newsweek as one of the 50 most influential rabbis in America. Mm. And her greatest achievement, she's an officer of the New York Board of Rabbis. I'm talking about Rabbi Sarah Hurwitz. Good morning, Rabbi.
Thank you so much for having me. It's such a pleasure and honor to be here with both of you.
Thank you. So,
indeed. Welcome.
The question obviously people are going to be asking is, what's a rabbi as opposed to a rabbi?
Rabbi is rabbi. I am a rabbi. I do the work of a rabbi. And the title, the nomenclature, is just a little bit different because as a Orthodox female rabbi, there was a lot of sensitivity about that word, rabbi, which has been held for 2,000 years by men, 200,000 years by men, and 2,000 years by men. And so in order to give an authentic feel to the job that I would be performing and to make it acceptable for the community in which I was functioning in, we tried to take away some of the tension around title and to make it a little bit different. But I think the job of what I do is the same as rabbis from across the denominational spectrum.
I'm going to be very curious in this interview because I'm learning. So what does it mean, an open Orthodox Jewish spiritual leader? What does that mean? I mean, is it that this is not something that's usually public? How does it work?
There are, of course, different denominations within Judaism. And then within each denomination, there's a spectrum of the way in which people affiliate with the community they most feel part of. I just love the word Orthodox, meaning that is my community that I chose. I became religious when I was 12. I picked the Orthodox community. It's the place where I feel connected, where my family is growing up and evolving within that community. But I think that the word open conveys being part of the secular world, the world at large, and being open to the ways in which that impacts my Orthodox Judaism, and Orthodox Judaism, my tradition, impacts the world around me. It's an integrative notion and idea that I'm fully living in the world and not closed and separated from the world around me.
You know, you said earlier.
So important. I just want to follow that up because that's so important, Rabbi. You know, coming from my faith tradition and outside of that, because when we think of Orthodox, especially here in New York, Rabbi, that means separate. But she's saying that she's engaged and very involved in the culture itself.
Correct.
Yeah, and also being with the Board of Rabbis, she's part of a pluralistic body, so she's able to relate not only to the Orthodox denomination, but also with people who are not in that denomination. So you can bring Rabbi Sara to all the different groupings, and she'll find a place for herself. Now, Rabbi, you know, there's some people who use the title Rabbanit. How does that differ from your title?
So Maharat, which is the first institution to ordain Orthodox women as rabbis, we are a global institution. We have 60 graduates around the world and 60 more coming up through the pike. Our focus is on creating 21st century rabbis that are serving the 21st century community. And what that means is that we're very focused on the curriculum and what they need to serve our community in the best way. And so we give the title with the credential of smicha or ordination. We do not give our graduates a title. We think titles are important. We want everybody to have a title, but we decided to allow the hiring institutions and the graduates themselves to pick the title that is most suitable for them so that the title doesn't distract from the work that they're doing. The reason why we came up with this is when I was ordained in 2009 by my mentor, Rabbi Avi Weiss, and Rabbi Daniel Sperber, I had the title initially of Maharat, which is actually an acronym that describes the job of a rabbi, somebody who's a leader, a spiritual leader, somebody who's a teacher, a scholar. And there was very little controversy, and so I changed my title from Maharat to Rabbah. And there was a firestorm that broke out. And what that taught me is that the Orthodox community is sensitive around language. And we wanted to just get out of that conversation. And so we have Rabbi, Rabbanit, or whatever title makes sense for that, for a graduate coming out of Maharat.
Right. I see. Now, obviously, there's going to be some opposition. You faced criticism. You mentioned the word tension before. How do you deal with that? People say, look, we can't accept, having a woman in the pulpit. What is your response to that?
Well, it's happening. and I also understand that we are not going to break that highest and hardest feeling for every part of the community. But there's so much work to do in the areas and the places within the community that are accepting. And what I want to say is that, I was ordained in 2009, and there was some controversy around that time. But now, 15 years later, there are many positions that are open for Orthodox women in assistant pulpit positions in the Orthodox community. There is much more acceptance. There was a survey that just came out that says that within the modern Orthodox community in general, something like 65% of the community believes that women should have some kind of pulpit role, and that's up 15% from 2017. So every year, it becomes more normalized for the community to see Orthodox women in these positions. That doesn't mean that it's not without controversy. And for me, it's about changing hearts and minds on the ground. And once you have women serving in these positions and the community sees how special and what added value they have to the community, what they give and offer, it becomes less of an issue. It just becomes more normalized.
So let me ask you, Rabbi, we're living in this time of polarization. We see it politically. We also see it religiously. Your mentor, your rabbinical guide, Rabbi Avi Weiss, whom we all come to know and admire over the years, wrote a column recently, which I'm sure you read, about aggressive compromise. Mm-hmm. And we don't find too many places that embrace compromise, let alone aggressive compromise. Any thoughts in terms of trying to bring people closer to one another? I mean, we're seeing this bridge, this separation. And I know in your community, you're very successful. I've been to your synagogue, and you see people very young, very old, all the different, you know, ages, people who are not that religious coming to synagogue. What are your thoughts about getting people to look at each other, see the sameness, and accept the difference?
What I've noticed over the years is that we become so focused on disagreeing with the issue that we there's vitriol that becomes personal, and we forget that it's just that we're disagreeing with about a topic and not with a person. And so we lash out personally at the person we're arguing with and begin to lose focus on what the argument was even about. And I've noticed that arguments become much more, are much more personal. And I think that machloket, disagreeing, is a natural part of not only our Jewish tradition, but the world. I don't think it's healthy for everybody to just agree and to have complete unanimous ideas, that there's no growth in creativity. And so I think that we have to cultivate a ability to especially disagree on an issue, but not hate generate like negative feelings against the person we're disagreeing with. It's okay. It's okay to disagree, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't be able to sit together at a Shabbat table or sit next to each other in synagogue or look at one each other and have positive experiences or, you know, have our kids come together around an experience of joy. And I think that's what community is. It's not only gathering around difficult contentious moments, but being able to gather around things that values that bring us together around happy occasions. And I think that's what builds community.
Rev, don't we say iron sharpens iron?
Sharpens iron, that's right?
And therefore, when we have people who have these sharp disagreements, they also have an opportunity on both sides to better understand the other, to maybe sharpen their own arguments after listening to them. But you got to, recently at Stanford University of Law, I don't know if you saw it, but a judge was invited and he was heckled. He's the invitee. He was heckled during his presentation at the law. Right? It's disgusting. I mean, here you have someone you want to hear his point of view, and then you make it impossible for him to share his point of view. And this is on a graduate level. So we
see that happen all the time.
Yeah.
We can't see past the issue that we feel so passionately about And you know, even if it means being disrespectful to the person who is offering that advice. How yeah. crazy would it be if we were able to step back and say, you know what, I was wrong.
Yeah.
But we, it's good, not an honor.
Good luck. we await those words very often.
Yeah. It's about learning to listen, and we're not listening as society. Rabbi and I hosted the mayor of New York City to have a conversation and to challenge him, you know, with some of the big questions. And, you know, we had hecklers. We had protests who broke into the meeting. And it's unfortunate when we attack the person and not stop to listen and hear the merits of that person's argument. How can we move forward if we simply determine in advance a conversation whether someone's on our side or not? And if they're not, we don't want to hear the rest of what they have to say.
You know what, Rabbi, Reverend Bernard will often call me, or I'll call him and ask him about some statement in the other's religious tradition. And when we give our answer, sometimes it's coupled with, well, some say this, some say that. That's well known in Jewish tradition. And even on the Christian side, there are different points of view. And here we are with religions that welcome debate. And yet, when we get beyond the textbook in everyday living, somehow we don't participate in that meaningful debate, rather in denigration of the other.
Yeah.
I can even just think about my own experience. And when I don't think that I have what I call MS or truth about every topic, I feel that the way and the path that I've picked for myself is right for me, is right for my family. But it doesn't mean that it's right for everybody else. And so when somebody disagrees with me on a topic, I feel confident about my way, but I understand that they may be coming from a different perspective. But if when somebody criticizes me personally and probably doesn't even know me or challenges something, you know, about the way I look or the way a misunderstanding of me, that's when it's painful because they're not arguing with me on equal terms. They're making assumptions about who I am. And I can't even argue around that or have a dialogue about that.
Yeah, and it's unfortunate because we live at a time where there's a lot of confirmation bias. There's a tendency to interpret what people are saying as confirmation of what we believe already or theories that we've been exposed to. And once we hear that word or that phrase that confirms our bias, we've come to judgment. That's it. That's done.
Yeah.
And that's problematic in our society.
Rabbi, before we let you go, one last question. I read that your favorite holiday or holy day is Yom Kippur.
Now, there's no secrets out there, huh?
What's that?
There's no secrets out there.
So, you know, people say Yom Kippur, it's a day of fasting, it's a day of discomfort, and yet for Rabbi Hurwitz, it's her favorite day. Explain that.
What an amazing opportunity we have to try again, to have a do-over, to have a day of reflection where we're focusing on our internal selves, also thinking about our relationships, both with our loved ones, as well as with God. And we get to take a day out of the year and pause, hit the pause button, reflect, and think about what we want to do better, how we want to be better, how we want to talk to people better. I feel that it's a gift to have that opportunity where we're given us another opportunity, a second chance to do better and be better.
All right. Well, Rev, you've met a rabbi. You know a rabbi. Maybe one day you can introduce a Reva. We have a Rev. Maybe a Reva.
A Reva.
Well, you know, in your denomination, Rev. Right? But
I didn't get to ask you those questions.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Let me tell you.
It would have been great hearing your perspective.
You know,
Rabbi.
We give out an award each year called the Maushewitz Prize. Someone who's done outstanding work in the community, and this year we're awarding Rabbi Sarah Hurwitz. And in listening to her, you can understand why. It was unanimous. She is so deserving of our commendation, because what she has done in community is extraordinary. And again, go to the synagogue in Riverdale that she serves. Talk to her colleagues of all the different denominations, and they will tell you she is impactful. She is someone who has made a difference, and we're very fortunate to have her with us.
Thank you.
Be well.
Thank you so much for being on the program.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Bye-bye. All right. Bye-bye. God bless. Bye-bye. And shalom, right, Rabbi?
Very good. That was very good. You pronounced it properly. I've never heard anybody mispronounce shalom. I get it all my years. I've heard him mispronounce so many other Hebrew words, but not that one.
Not that one.
Yeah. Although
stay tuned.
Yeah, I think we'll in Hawaii, back. By the way, in Hawaii they say shaloha.
Shaloha.
Right.
We better take a break after that one. Stay tuned. We'll be back for the close of the Rev and the Rabbi right here on 77 WABC.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.
Reverend A.R. Bernard, Rabbi Joseph Potasnik, where faith matters. The Rev and the Rabbi. Talk Radio 77 WABC and the all-new WABCRadio.com.
Welcome back. I'm Rabbi Joseph Potasnik.
And I'm Reverend A.R. Bernard. Where do we start unpacking these two incredible guests,
well,
Rabbi?
Let's find common ground. You know, the word kvetch, I'm sure you've heard it, means complain. And sometimes you listen to people who constantly complain, telling you all of the wrongs of life, all of the problems of life, how miserable life is. Now you have two guests, Sister and the Rabbi, and they bring this positive energy, this love of life, love of people, and how refreshing is that?
Rabbi, amazing. I will tell you, just starting with Sister Jean, to be able to have this kind of a conversation with someone that is 103 years old and yet can reflect very easily and remember when she was a child, how she felt, what she thought, this sense of calling early in her life, you know, that's special, Rabbi. That is special.
But, you know, I think it's a message for all of us to find something in life that we love. Whether it's in our profession, whether it's in our personal life. I was talking to someone today, maybe we'll have her on the program at some point. She is a national sleep expert, talking about the importance of sleep. And I said to her in our conversation, tell me how to get a restful night's sleep. You know, how do I sleep? She said, the first thing you do is when you get into bed, think of something positive. Think of something you're grateful about. Something perhaps that happened during the day, trying to turn it into a positive message. Don't go to sleep with that negative, nagging feeling. Now, that's easier said than done, but it's a way of changing our perspective. And you have two people today who certainly have that perspective of seeing the beauty of life, not the ugliness. They're not ignoring it, but they're not allowing that ugliness to blind them from the goodness they see.
Exactly. And these are women who have made a difference. You know, Title IX, you and I were talking during the break about Sister mentioned Title IX. And that was this, you know, breaking and prohibiting discrimination based upon sex in terms of education, activities and programming in the educational system. We've come a long way. Now we're wrestling through some other issues, which would be a whole another program of issues within athletics and sports concerning women.
Yeah.
You know,
I don't criticize people who feel, let's say, in the religious arena, we should have only men. There are those who believe that, and I respect that fully. On the other hand, there's a place for women also, and we don't look to impose our way on others, and others shouldn't impose their way on us. I think in the religious world, I think God's world is big enough to say we can find specialized areas for each of you to bring something of your talent to other people. We don't have to exclude
you.
Now, maybe we can redefine the role. Maybe, you know, as Rabbi Sarah said, for some, the title for a woman as rabbi is difficult to accept. So what do? We took the name Rabbah, or we Rabbanit. We did something to show sensitivity that maybe in your community, your congregation, that title wouldn't fit well. So pick a different title. Let's not get hung up on titles. Let's get focused on responsibility, because we certainly need more people helping others come closer to God.
I think these kind of accommodations don't violate orthodoxy, and you know what I mean, in terms of our faith and the fundamental tenets of our faith. And I think it's so important. And, you know, we're wrestling through in our faith tradition, Rabbi, the place of women, the role of women in, you know, as pastors, being able to teach and all of this. We're still wrestling through all of those things. And I'm sure it's the same thing in your faith tradition.
Of course, absolutely. And there are those who will say, look, this is my tradition. I can't accept, you know, changing the tradition. I say, okay, I'm not arguing for you to change it. I just want you to recognize that others may find their view of tradition different than yours. Allow them that. Respect that. They're not denying yours. Don't you deny theirs.
Yeah, yeah. And look, I must say this, going back to Sister Jean, I didn't know that people actually put a bar of soap in your mouth. I saw that. The Christmas Story. Those of you are familiar with that old movie, The Christmas Story, and he ended up with a bar of soap. But, you know, our producer, Kevin, KD, Kevin Ropes, he chimed in and said that it happened to him. He had a bar of soap.
Yeah, I don't know how long-lasting that effect was on him. I've heard him, you know, talk. But you know,
he's still got the bubbles coming out. Let's put it that way.
yeah. But, you know, here it is, Women's History Month, and we had two people, different generations, and yet so much in common.
Great broadcast, great guests, just an amazing Sunday morning again.
Thank you. The Reverend the Rabbi.
Right here on 77 WABC. We'll be back next time. Till then, be well. Be blessed.